Good morning. This is Right Here, Right Now, brought to you by Right Choice Services. At Right Choice Services, we develop individualized programs to help clients find that book inside of them that they have always wanted to write. And I'm your host, Tim Morrison. On Right Here, Right Now, we interview business leaders, entrepreneurs, and professionals about their work and the writing they engage in as a part of their work. My co-host and producer for Right Here, Right Now is Kevin Finn. Kevin wears a whole lot of hats at Business Radio X, but from my perspective, the best one is being my co-host and producer. Good morning.
Good morning, Tim. Best part of my day today.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. This is kind of a, what should we say, a warm, fuzzy show for you today because of one of my guests.
Oh, yeah. It was a great surprise. Someone I've known since I was 2 years old. So
that was just yesterday, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. Well, Lee Lambert, as I will introduce in a little bit, she was just kind of blown away, too, when she got the email from me saying, and this is who my co-host is. And I got to say that this is a special show for me because we're dealing with my hometown in a peculiar sort of way. One of our other guests, Emma Goda, her dad is the pastor of the church that I grew up in Greenville, Pennsylvania. He wasn't there then. I'm older than he. So, but at any rate, I know we have listeners from back home in Greenville. This is going to be fun.
Oh, yeah. This is a super double warm fuzzy show for us.
Yeah, exactly. So who is doing what to provide a voice for the voiceless? What individuals or organizations generate meaningful dialogue and a positive exchange of ideas? This edition of Right Here, Right Now provides a look into two very different approaches to bring the hope of being heard and a positive exchange of ideas to thousands, if not millions, of people. Chad Pease and Emma Goda join us by telephone from San Diego to tell us about the Independent Voter Network, an online news platform for communication between independent-minded voters, public officials, civic leaders, and journalists. And the purpose of the Independent Voter Network is to provide unfiltered, I like that, unfiltered political news and policy analysis across the political spectrum. And in the second interview, I will talk with Lee Lambert, author of The Caregiver's Companion. And Lee is in the studio with Kevin and me, and through her book and other activities, Lee seeks to provide a platform so caregivers may have a voice and be supported through the empowerment of the individual, the family, and the community. So let's turn first to our guests who have called in from the West Coast, where it is still o-dark early for them. And thank you for getting up so early to call in and talk with us. Welcome, Chad and Emma.
Good morning.
Thank you for having us.
It's a delight. Is the sun up yet out there?
Not yet.
Not yet. Oh, my goodness. Well, really, I'm so glad you're on. So our first question, not to be a surprise, tell us about the Independent Voter Network. What is it? What does it do? How did it come to be?
That's a lot of questions. The Independent Voter Network is both, it's on a technological level, it's a platform, it's a big development project, and I think on a dialogue level, it's a an avenue to try to elevate the discourse in our political dialogue. It came about as it came out of a project by the Independent Voter Project out here in California, where the first real goal was really just to educate voters about their voting rights. It was a completely nonpartisan venture to reach voters and say, hey, you have the right to vote in this primary, or hey, this election's coming up. This is what you need to do. From that, we ended up turning it, we kind of looked at each other and decided, hey, we can make this a bigger venture if we really want to inject a level of nonpartisanship and raise the level of discourse. You need to start with the news, the dialogue itself. And so we deconstructed what was our old website and created a new one. And for the last year, we've been building this platform that's really at its most foundational level is just a platform for people who have newsworthy content of journalistic quality to put it into the news cycle and distribute it through our social media channels so we can start affecting the dialogue on a larger level.
Do you have guidelines so that you don't get rants, or if you do get rants, you can say that ain't going to fly?
Right. Well, there's a general guideline that our editors, it has to be of journalistic quality, so our editors are both moderators and editors, but we also have an etiquette which we take very, very, very seriously, and the etiquette's pretty simple. There's four guidelines. There's no personal attacks, no self-promotion, sources must be substantiated, and there's no partisan-based attacks. And we believe that if we hold true to these core principles, that we can get people to start talking to each other, not past one another. And so we don't devolve into this bickering back and forth, he said, she said type stuff. And we can focus on what's really important.
So not like the debate last night. You want to get away from it.
Not like any of the debates.
I like to hear that. That's good.
Yeah. Chad, what is your role or position with IVN?
Well, I'm the founder of IVN, so I guess at the end of the day, you know, I think I'm the guy you point the finger at if you see something that doesn't follow the etiquette, or, you know, even if it's, you know, something goes wrong with the site, it's my fault.
That's an image. Emma, what's your role with IVN?
I handle all our public relations here.
And how did you
making sure this guy looks good?
Okay, and we want to give you some good airtime here for the people from Greenville that are listening. How did you wind up with IVN? Because that's not what you first did when you were out there, was it?
No. When I first came out here, I was actually working for an attorney, and I ended up meeting Chad through a mutual friend that he went to law school with.
Okay. Are you enjoying your affiliation with what they're trying to do, and what role do you play other than, and I don't want to belittle that, the PR stuff?
I am enjoying it. I think it's something that's really important, and just to be a part of, you know, a startup like this that we're trying to, you know, change the face of the media is really important.
Okay. Chad, is the platform working the way you envisioned? Are you getting the responses, the articles, the contributions, or whatever?
Yes, I think more so than probably we expected. And I'd say the hardest part about what we're doing, I think it's part of the reason why our media has gotten to where it is because it's difficult to run a successful news operation online, and I think everyone's still trying to figure it out. One thing to drive a lot of hits and traffic is to sensationalize headlines and to say things that encourage people to comment. A lot of times these are things that may not elevate the dialogue, really just stimulate the bickering and like I mentioned, the he said, she said type stuff that mm-hmm. we see even in the presidential debates. So on the one hand, our target, I guess if you want to call it a market, is what we call the passive participant. It's the person that's not going to jump up at a sensationalized headline or jump out of their seat because somebody says something that they don't agree with. So, you know, we limit ourselves, our ability to go out and drive that kind of traffic. On the other hand, the people that stay around and view IVN every day, I think, have an elevated sense of respect for all people across the political dialogue that are willing to come onto the platform and just have a civil conversation and know, okay, I'm going to talk to the people that come here all the time on this level, and I'm not really concerned about writing my headline or putting something in my story that's going to, you know, poke somebody in the butt, for lack of better terms.
I like that. And remember, we're not FCC compliant. We don't have to worry about that, but thank you. How do people contribute? Do you go looking for contributors? Do they say, here I am, call on me, you know, try me, or what?
We have actually a variety of ways that we get contributors. On its most basic level, we have our office. We have an office of, you know, I like to say we're the least political office. You know, we all have probably a little more political, I guess, savvy than the average person just because we live around it, but moderate's not the right term, but we're not so, I guess, hard-headed in our ideologies. So we all try to kind of take a more temperate approach to what's going on and produce news ourselves. We also have regular contributors literally from all across the country. We have something over 150 regular contributors now that contribute everywhere from a couple times a week to once every couple months. Then every day we have new people that just go to our, you know, ivn.us/submit, and they submit an article. We even say, do you expect compensation? Some people put a compensation amount, some don't. And then sometimes, you know, Emma will be on the phone, or she'll field phone calls or make phone calls, and we get op-ed type pieces. For example, we have lots of confusing propositions out here in California. So we make calls to the different campaigns and say, hey, do you guys want to write a piece that's directed at independent-minded voters? And, you know, here's our etiquette guidelines. And we've been pleasantly surprised with the amount of people willing to do that if you provide them the platform.
Yeah, it sounds like you guys are trying to provide unbiased, factual information. I was curious, just because it seems like you're going to have a lot of different people posting. Do you have user moderators, like a lot of these different websites, that people actually will find it or fact check it for you and report it? Or how do you guys do that?
Right. In the immediate term, what we do, we have a box like on the side of every article. It says good, bad journalism, and you know, you can select good or bad, and we monitor the posts for people that are clicking bad. If you click that, it asks you to say why and to say does it violate one of our etiquette guidelines? And then we have the whole office monitoring for that kind of stuff in the short term. You know, in the long term, like I said, this is a technological, you know, venture as well. There's a lot of things we're in the midst of programming that aren't quite ready yet. Really, at the end of the day, we envision it being a user-driven news source. So on the one hand, there's the development on the technology side that we have a little ways to go. But on the other side, it's a matter of, hey, can we cultivate a community that really understands the etiquette and really understands the long-term goal, so when we get to that point that the users are really driving the content and moderating the content, that that they do a good job of it.
But I think the key there too, Chad, is what you mentioned at the beginning, that you do check everything out. You measure it against your four principles. You know, you don't take on personal attacks. You back everything up and that kind of thing. Do your editors, do you all read through those things? How do you put that check in place?
Well, you know, the power to publish, is held by our core group of editors. So they're responsible at the end of the day for not letting anything get published unless it meets those editorial standards and the etiquette guidelines. So, if it does get published, somehow it gets past an editor and something squeaks by, then it goes to everybody in our office and our user community to point it out.
Oh, okay. And you pay attention to that then, obviously.
Yeah, right. We say it with everything we do. We always say the number one thing is that it's got to follow the etiquette, because that's what we're founded on. That's our core.
Emma, what's it like to be the PR person for this organization? Is it a fun job? Do people say, oh, you're with them? Or talk to us a little bit about what you do.
I would definitely say it's a fun job. Every day is a new day, and just, you know, reaching out. A lot of people feel that what we're doing is competition with them, but we're not competition at all.
Because?
Because we're a news, we're a platform. We provide a platform for contributors to contribute their own material. We're not professional journalists.
Okay, I like that, and I pushed you on that because it doesn't matter. You can stand on top of a mountain and say, we're not competitors, and your competitors are those who see themselves as competitors aren't going to believe you. But
exactly.
Do you just sit in the office and put out stuff, or do you go out and speak on behalf of IVN? What do you do?
You know what? I do a lot in our office. I try to drag Chad out to some networking events throughout the week, and, you know, just trying to get us more face time is really important right now, because they've done all the work on the back end of the site, and now it's just getting visibility across the United States.
Okay, and we like to think that your appearance on right here right now is going to help that, since you will get the URL for this, and you can incorporate that in your PR stuff, right?
Yes, absolutely. We appreciate that.
Well, how did, how, you know, you called me, you emailed me a couple of weeks ago, just completely out of the blue. We have exchanged emails in the past, but what prompted you to turn to Right Here, Right Now?
You know, I got your newsletter, and I was just thinking about how, you know, you write books and everything, so I just thought it might be a good opportunity to see if you were interested in possibly contributing to our site. And then you told me about Business X, and I thought it would be, you know, something good that we could do for IBN.
And it's working so far, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Chad, are you paying her well for this?
I don't pay people.
That was a good answer, too. How did this concept develop? I know you touched on that a little bit at the beginning, but this is a huge undertaking, and it's a refreshing undertaking from my perspective. How did it come about?
Well, you know, there's a short answer and a long answer, and you're probably more interested in the short answer.
Oh, I'll take an in-between.
I'll try to get something in between. I guess it developed a while ago. I got involved kind of in the online political community about 4 or 5 years ago, about the time, you know, when the Tea Party was first starting. I'm not really sure what it devolved into. I think there's good people in the Tea Party, but on its whole, I don't think it's been good for the dialogue per se. But I got involved back then, subsequently went back to law school. But in that whole time, just because of the people that I associate myself with and my past relationships with website developers and stuff, we all came to kind of the common kind of agreement that, you know, you can have these movements, you can go on a piece by piece, okay, here's a good reform measure, or, you know, here's a good movement where we're going for these goals. And all of those things are admirable, and there's good, and we like to think there's, you know, good and bad in everything, whether it's Occupy or Tea Party or Democrats or Republican. It's not so black and white where, oh, everything's good about this or everything's bad. But we had a belief that the only way to really change things for the good on the whole is to change the dialogue, is not just to have a one goal here or a reformed there. It's, we need to fundamentally change the way we talk to each other. We can never come to some kind of cooperative agreement or the purpose of government isn't to be right or to take a group's of answers and then implement a group's ideology. The purpose of government is to find temporary solutions, to find a temporary compromise between people that inherently disagree. So if we try to make the goal of government to put in what we believe is right all the time, we're taking away what government is at its core. So I guess that's kind of what drove us to do what we do, is we saw that the media is following along the same lines as the partisanship that drives Washington, D.C., is we frame every single issue, every single debate, not in terms of, okay, how do we take these differing opinions and do something better? But how do we take these opinions and create a debate and a confrontation between people? We just fundamentally think that we need to change the way we look at problems into how do we find solutions, not where do we create the divide.
I absolutely love that. Just the fact that we don't really have any true news sources anymore. All news corporations are owned, and they make a bunch of money. And we don't have really any unbiased news, and everyone has their own news network that tells them exactly what they want to hear, and we have politicians lying left and right to us. So I think what you guys are doing is really great, and hopefully it can make an impact and start educating people and giving them unbiased, true information they can actually use to start fixing these problems and having a good forum between each other.
Yeah.
Right. And, on that point, I like to say, like, as an organization, we are unbiased, but like we mentioned the term unfiltered, is that, you know, our individual contributors have their own bias. And that's our belief, is that, you know, the contributors are welcome, and we encourage biases from all across the political spectrum as long as they talk, you know, and they abide by the etiquette. For example, literally just 20 minutes ago, believe it or not, you know, it was a surprise to us, we published an article by Grover Norquist. And, you know, one of the people in our, he submitted his press person on behalf of him submitted an original editorial on Proposition 36, a prison proposition here in California. And one of the persons from our office said, you know, we'd be happy to publish this. Here's a couple things that you need to do so it meets the etiquette guidelines first, and they did. And we published it. I mean, no one's going to deny that Grover Norquist has his own biases.
That's true. Well, Chad, what kind of writing do you do yourself?
I don't do as much as I would like, but I do quite a bit of writing. I tend to not, you know, try to talk about things more on the whole, just in terms of what things mean to independent-minded voters and just as a political kind of culture we're going. Okay. Because I think, you know, as being a founder and I guess the moderator of the whole thing, it's important that I keep myself out of the appearance of bias, you know, injecting my own personal beliefs on some of this stuff.
Out of the firing line, we say, right?
Right, right. And, you know, I'd like to comment, and I do on some things, but I think it's important that at the end of the day, you know, I'm talking on behalf of the network sometimes. So I really need to have an elevated sense of, you know what, if this is going to be a level playing field for everybody, I have to make sure that I'm a fair referee.
Okay. Emma, do you do any writing?
I just started doing a little bit of writing. I do more, we just localized San Diego, so the writing that I've been doing is more fun pieces, I would say, like yoga and rock climbing and things that I enjoy to do outdoors.
Okay, that's good. We like that. So, here's your chance. How do people contact you? They want to learn more about you, whatever.
Well, we can go to IBN.us. You can click the About section, and there's a whole video on what we're doing. There's a contact form that we are always welcome comments and people asking questions. We just launched, you know, Emma touched on it, IVN San Diego, which we're trying to localize here in as many cities as possible, obviously funding permitting, so that we can kind of bring it down to the, you know, the regular person who's not looking up politics every 2 seconds of their life.
Okay.
And we want to kind of bring that same kind of civil dialogue to even the more, like, fun things, like Emma put it.
Great.
Can't we talk about the cool yoga studios and the cool bars and the history behind them in our own cities? And then at the same time, you know, filter in some political stuff is important to everybody.
Well, so, I need to move on to our next guest. I got to tell you, Lee has been taking copious notes while you've been talking. I mean, she's filled up volumes of paper. Don't want to put any pressure on you in terms of you better be taking notes, but just thought I'd let you know that since you can't see. You guys willing to sit around and listen to this interview and then we can have a conversation?
Sure.
Great.
We'll
appreciate
be right
it.
Here.
Okay. Well, Lee Lambert, welcome.
Thank you.
You probably thought you were never going to get on today, but we had one going. But, you know, the nice thing about this is your challenge is to keep us going just as long, and I'm sure we can. Lee, you once owned a construction company. Is that correct?
I did.
You weren't expecting that question, were you?
No, I wasn't.
Oh, well, I want to let them know that, you know, you're more than just a good writer, good conversationalist. I'd say.
I thought you were going to say pretty face.
Well, I was going there, but people have to take my word for it. You know, they can't see you, but trust me, she is. So, you once owned a construction company. How did that come about, and did you sell it? What did you do?
Well, I started a construction company because I used to work in this area managing a couple of million square feet for the King and Queen buildings.
Mm-hmm.
And so, after about 3.5 years, I was totally burnt out and started my own projects, you know, because I'm just an entrepreneur. I'm not a good employee.
I understand that role. Same for me. And so you then you held that, you divested of it, or?
Well, actually, in the late 80s, I decided, even though we were doing really well, that I went into manufacturing because of the steel case furniture that was out there in abundance. And so I started a manufacturing company, and over the course of 12 years, we grew to about 80 people. And we were like the second largest in the country.
Oh, goodness. Goodness. I wanted to frame this for where we're going to go so that people understand that, that you know work and you know how to build things up. Where along the line did you step away from the business? You went to take care of your father. How did that come about?
Well, my father got Alzheimer's.
Mm-hmm.
And as a matter of fact, Kevin's family were dealing with the same issue at the same time that I was. And his stepmother is my closest friend. And so our fathers had Alzheimer's together at the same time.
Mm.
But I took care of my father for about 15 years.
Wow. That was a lot longer than you probably ever anticipated.
Well, I cherish every day.
I'm sure you do. What were some of the struggles that you had with that? When, you know, I think when people go into caregiving, so to speak, and I speak to this out of my background in hospice, I think we go in thinking a few weeks, maybe month, maybe a year at most. Was there a point at which you said, wait a second, this is a lot more than I anticipated, where's the end?
No.
Okay.
I never felt that way. It was always my intention to be able to take care of my father,
mm-hmm.
you know, when he got older. And so I never felt that way.
Okay. He understood that you were there helping,
mm-hmm.
at least at the beginning, because he would not have been in the complete clutches of Alzheimer's.
Well, you know, he never did not recognize me. And when he didn't seem to be fully there, all I had to say was, I love you.
Mm-hmm.
And there he was.
Wow. That's exciting. What did you learn about the caregiving journey?
Well, I talk about it
mm-hmm.
In the book, and I call it the painful gift, because it's a process that a caregiver goes through over a long period of time
mm-hmm.
that can be transformative. And it's what you have to do while you're caregiving, because it is a very painful process, is you have to learn how to channel that pain. It can actually become fuel. If you don't channel the pain towards something positive, then you end up reaching for things that are not positive.
Can you talk a little bit more about that pain? What's the source of it?
Well, if you think about it, whenever there's hardship in someone's life, it is you have choices. And those choices happen every day and every minute of every day. And, you know, you've heard people say, I felt like my feet were on fire. Well, during caregiving, it's like your feet burned off a long time ago. So it's just a process that is over such a long period of time that you really have to be very determined in your approach.
Okay, you did not work outside of caregiving when you took care of your dad, or did you?
I tried to,
mm-hmm.
but I really couldn't. If I didn't, even after he was out of the house,
mm-hmm.
I couldn't. I had to go see him almost every day,
mm-hmm.
or he would start to go downhill.
Okay, so you did move him to a facility then?
I did, and that happened when one day I was home alone with him, which normally there was someone there, and he had become incontinent.
Mm-hmm.
And at that moment, you know, I realized that I couldn't manage him
mm-hmm.
any longer. And aside from that, you know, in the middle of the night, he would wander. So it was a safety issue.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, one morning, I heard a knock on the door at about 7 a.m. And I opened the door, and there was Daddy with Marty, my neighbor.
Oh.
He didn't even know Marty.
Oh.
But he had gone down the street, and Marty had brought him back, and they had breakfast together.
Oh, my. That had to be a surprise.
It was. It was a scary surprise.
Sure it would be. And that's when you began to think about, we've got to do placement here.
That's right. And it really was the best decision, not just for me, but for him.
Mm-hmm.
There's a point at which you don't want to go beyond because of safety.
Mm-hmm.
And then you find out that it is an incredible vehicle for them to stay social and alert and engaged.
And that's a good feeling, isn't it?
It really is. But you have to stay completely involved as well.
Well, I think what you do there is you've lifted up one of those tipping points, if you will, for a lot of people. You know, I'm going to take care of my mom, my dad, my whomever, all the way. And that's not necessarily the wise thing to do.
It is not the wise thing to do. And there is a lot of guilt associated when you make that decision. And I actually wrote about that, saying that I felt like I was sending my father to the gas chamber, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. In fact, that point in time was the most painful time that I ever experienced. It was more painful than when my father died.
Wow. How did you overcome that pain then?
I don't think that you overcome pain. I think that you it becomes a very precious part of mm-hmm. who you are and who you become because of the pain.
But you did see how he became a more sociable individual in the facility?
Oh, absolutely.
And so that would help with it somewhat, wouldn't it?
I'm
not arguing that the pain didn't go away, but I'm thinking of our listeners who, oh, I'm going to hurt whether I put them in or whether I don't put them in. And we need to look at that whole picture, which you had mentioned earlier.
You know, the best way to alleviate and to manage this process is to be prepared for it ahead of time.
Okay.
Because this is about logistics, but it's also about emotions. And the emotions are much easier to deal with if the logistics are under control.
Say more about that. I like that, but say more so our people will understand fully.
Sure. Well, you talked about the book, and actually the book has changed names. In fact, the way that I started writing was just to heal, just a process of healing. Mm-hmm. I didn't intend on really writing a book. And then the book, I wrote my raw story of what happened, and it was healing. And then I started writing some of the emotional conclusions I came to, which became insights that I wanted to share with mm-hmm. other people. And then it morphed into a system. And that system is what I'm right now working hard to finish up the development on.
Okay. I was curious because I was just thinking about it. Can you ever really be prepared to be a caregiver? I think about it on terms of like being a parent. I know everyone always says you can't really prepare to be a parent. You can do a lot of preparation, but you can never prepare for it. Can you really prepare for taking care of your parents when they've sort of gone downhill more to the more childlike state? Or
you can prepare to be in the right frame of mind. And you can prepare for all of the logistics. Emotionally, you need to prepare to be in the right frame of mind. And when you do that, then it becomes all about love. And I think the most important thing that people can do is to be able to have the logistics handled so they can focus on love. And what happens is, especially in families, you know, where the family dynamics kick in, I try to talk to people about elevating the principle of what they're doing. And so what I suggest that they look at is that they are serving their parent. They are serving a higher principle. They're serving love. They're serving family. instead of focusing on bedpans and adult diapers and who didn't do what, when you serve something higher and it's bigger than the individuals involved, then it becomes a whole different engagement.
It transforms.
It does.
Yeah. You don't mention any siblings. You don't mention a mother. You were all alone on this one?
I was.
Wow. That is a journey. That is a journey. What was, for you, what surprised you the most? And I'm not sure that's the right way to phrase it, but when you look back on that whole adventure, was it, oh, man, I never anticipated that, or was it one darn thing after another like that?
What it was for me, and I'll say something personal here. When I was building that company, and there were 80 families depending on me,
mm-hmm.
It was a very, very difficult and pressure cooker,
mm-hmm.
you know. And so control was a big thing for me. When I started caring for my father, it was like my identity went out the window. And financially, you know, it devastates you. All kinds of things happen so that you don't recognize who you are. And it's sort of like an avatar. What's the real world
mm-hmm.
in okay. here or out there?
Sure, sure.
And so it was a process of... for me personally, in learning how to love
mm-hmm.
unconditionally, and it helped me just generally and in my marriage to love in a way that I never have before. My father, taking care of him, it taught me that. It taught me to open my heart in a way that I have never imagined.
I like that, and I like your sharing that, and I appreciate that, because there is that piece to learn. My mother-in-law passed back in August after spending, I think it was about 16 months in a nursing home that initially she didn't want to go to, like many of our families don't want to do that. But once she got in there, and we like to say to her, once you got there and got in control and knew everybody, life changed for you. And that's exactly right. And we would ask her from time to time, would you like us to move you somewhere else? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. And she did pass in that nursing home, and we learned from one of my wife's brothers that the entire staff came through after they had heard that Ruth had passed. They came in to her room to say goodbye. And that is such a powerful image to me of how one person can go into a facility that we as the public tend to say, oh, man, I hope I don't have to go there, but make it special and make it real and touch lives.
Absolutely. And I like to pose questions, you know, and throw out some concepts about how to look at things in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's the whole thing right there, is how you view your situation. And one question I ask is it conditions that make us happy, or is it something else? And so when you think about that, and you rely on just the external things for, you know, happiness,
mm-hmm.
then you're going to be disappointed a lot, and you're going to go up and down emotionally, like a roller coaster.
Uh-huh. Okay. What other insights would you share?
Well, I would say that during the course of when you look at family dynamics and how they kick into this,
mm-hmm.
a lot of families are dealing with this now. There's over 64 million caregivers in the U.S. today.
These are just regular people.
These are family caregivers.
Okay. Wow.
And so more – and they're expected to be about 120 million by the year 2030. So when you look at family dynamics, you have a lot of different situations. Mm-hmm. And what happens is that whatever emotions that you have, whatever unresolved issues that you have, which everybody has, in their childhood, with their family are in your face.
Mm.
They're in your face. And so this is a huge opportunity, which, by the way, they don't have to cooperate
oh.
with. But it's a huge opportunity for whomever takes the opportunity
mm-hmm.
to develop themselves. Mm-hmm. Because these issues that haven't resolved themselves are the things that, if you look at them, they've been driving your life.
Oh, sure.
So you have an opportunity to heal those things or to try to avoid them even more, which is disastrous.
Boy, that's heavy. I like that image. I like that image. Kevin, is this triggering any memories for you, what you went through?
Well, yeah, with my I guess, step-grandfather, I don't mm-hmm. know. With him, yeah, there was a lot of memories there. And also, my uncle also went through Alzheimer's, my great-uncle.
Uh-huh.
My biggest memory was, I remember at the end of my great-uncle's life, remember I went over to his house. I'd visit him every Wednesday because we used to go out to dinner when I was a kid every Wednesday. So I'd go over every Wednesday night, bring some food. I went over, ate with him. Left, and about 30 minutes or 15 minutes later, I get a phone call, and he asked me when I was coming over and why I hadn't come over, and he was very upset, and that was just a really hard moment and really tough for me, and I've done a lot of research about Alzheimer's and everything. Mm-hmm. I think the biggest component that scares me is the financial component. People don't plan ahead enough for this, and then it ends up devastating people financially. I don't know. Do you talk about in your book at all the financial commitment, really how people need to be aware and start putting away money to take care of their parents when they're older? Because I don't think it's ever really crossed people's mind, because this has never happened before. People are living longer than they ever have before, and I think it's becoming a real problem.
They are living longer, and their diseases are more complex, and their financial affairs are more complex. And so the conversation that you need to have with your parents needs to take place very early on. I'm going to do another radio show tomorrow at the Lou Walker Senior Center. And the whole issue about seniors, the question is, do you want someone else to make decisions for you when you can no longer make them? Or do you want to put decisions in place that they implement? And I think it's a very important question and a very important issue that seniors need to participate in their own care, in their own future.
Yeah, okay. Just to tell anyone to have that kind of foresight and start planning ahead, I don't think a lot of people do that, but I really agree that they need to.
Preparation is everything, and my goal is to create that tipping point so people view it that way.
I like that. So what's next on your agenda?
What's next on my agenda?
Yeah.
More of the same. I mean, all of this is, there are infinite ways to tell this story.
Mm-hmm.
There are infinite ways to connect what needs to be done, to share the statistics, to wake people up, to ask them to think about this in a very serious way. And at the same time, there's a lot of humor.
Oh, sure.
In dealing with caregiving.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the funniest things that have ever happened to me have happened during the time that I was caring for my father.
I'm sure. And people don't take the time to understand that, do they? Or even allow themselves to see those moments.
They really don't. And again, when you have your logistics under control, then it allows you to enjoy this precious time that you have with your parents and this precious journey
mm-hmm.
that you're on.
Oh, that's great. Well, how do people contact you, Lee? They want to learn more about maybe your book or what you're doing, learn more from you.
Well, soon they will hopefully see me at a lot of different venues. They can visit on the website at leelambertcares.com. And we'll be populating that. We're about to launch this program over the next 2 to 3 months. And the program will be available for caregivers all across the country to be able to have a voice – to share what they know mm-hmm. with each other.
Okay.
And for us to communicate, and I will have some tools that we all need in order to get prepared.
We like that. And let me say, Lee spells her name the old-fashioned way, L-E-E. And it's L-E-E-L-A-M-B-E-R-T, cares, cares.com.
That's right.
How'd I do?
Perfect.
Great. Thanks. Well, hey, let's open up the mics to see if Chad and Emma have any questions for me or for you, or if you want to ask them anything. You guys are still with us, right?
We are still here.
Good. I didn't hear any snoring, so that's a real positive thing going on there. Well, I have a question wondering, do you, in the IVN, do you have anything dealing with the kind of topic that Lee has been discussing?
Well, actually, I mean, we do. We have all kinds of topics. I mean, we were just at a Parkinson's event the other night, and we just published an article today on how homelessness is a nonpartisan issue, and there's solutions. I mean, things like Alzheimer's or whatever the issue is, those are the things that need to be at the forefront of not only the political dialogue but our daily dialogue. Those are the things that we have to deal with at home that affect our regular lives. I mean, it's great to have all these talks about whether or not gay people should be getting married, but, you know, that does affect a lot of people's lives, but that it seems like our political dialogue revolves around those, like, few issues all day, year after year. I mean, the things that, like, Lee's talking about now, those are the things that are really affecting people's lives that we need to deal with. And so the short answer, I guess, is yes. We like to talk about those issues. I think they're the issues that need to be discussed.
I would love to contribute to your platform on this issue because it's a huge challenge. Alzheimer's alone. Sandra Day O'Connor said that Alzheimer's is the defining challenge of this next millennium. And that's just one disease. So, and there's a lot of advocacy that is needed on the part of the caregiver. People focus on the patient, and really in what I'm doing, I'm focused on the caregiver.
Mm-hmm. And truth in advertising, so to speak, on what it is to deal with that kind of thing.
Absolutely.
Emma, when I like what Chad was saying about the whole purpose of the Independent Voter Network. When you're out promoting the company or the program, the process, all of that, do you get challenged by people in terms of, isn't it better to take a stance than to try to compromise?
Yeah, actually, I was at an event on Friday, and, you know, we talked to both sides. And one of the things I was approached Friday, actually, at the event by someone who's running for mayor in San Diego, you know, he was upset because we ran an article on his opponent. And he said, I thought you were unbiased. And I said, we are. I said, you know, we're going to talk to you, but we're also going to talk to your opponent as well. So we are approached by that all the time.
People just, it's a hard concept to wrap around, isn't it? And that's really, people say to me, how do you bring these guests together? How do you figure these things out? And I say, in the deep, dark recesses of my mind, because what I've hoped our listeners today have experienced is that each of you speaks for the unspoken and tries to give voice where there is a lot of pain. Chad, when you talk about that, just that intense lack of dialogue, and I think the presidential debates have been a very good example of that. You know, I didn't listen to them because I didn't want to hear that nonsense. I wanted to deal with some truth. And Lee, I've been there not as a caregiver, but as a representative of agencies that provide the care, and I ache for the family, for the person himself or herself, and for the family when they're not sure how to communicate.
But the other part of this, there is a huge political side to this, and that is the whole issue of health care mm-hmm. and how family caregivers impact that landscape. Family caregivers represent $450 billion in unpaid services, according to the Family Caregiving Alliance. And if you want to have a reference point for that, for nursing home care and for home care combined, it only amounts to $150 billion. And so taking care of the caregiver and making sure that they have what they need and that they are cared for so that their health does not go downhill is a huge challenge that we need to address.
Sure we do. Well, you know, my friends, the clock is on us. We welcome your comments and suggestions about content and our guests. If you'd like to recommend a guest or be a guest yourself on Right Here, Right Now, let us know. Just send me an email at whwnbusinessradiox@gmail.com. Thank you, Kevin, always for co-hosting and keeping me somewhat on track.
I do my best. I get caught up in the interesting conversation.
I appreciate that. Thank you to our guests, Chad Peace and Emma Goda and Lee Lambert.
Thank you.
Chad and Emma, your contact information one more time, please.
Well, you can reach me at Chad, C-H-A-D, at IVN.us, and I'll get back to anybody.
Great. Emma, do you want to share your contact?
Yes, you can reach me at Emma, E-M-M-A, at IVN.us.
Okay, and Lee, your contact information?
It would be Lee at LeeLambertCares.com.
Okay. Right Here, Right Now is brought to you each week by Right Choice Services. And you can learn more about Right Choice Services and how we help individuals write the book they've always wanted to write at www.writechoiceservices.com. I hope you'll join us next week and tell your friends about the show. In fact, I always encourage you to send an email to them right now to invite them to listen live or to our downloads. Right Here, Right Now broadcasts live every Tuesday morning at 10 o'clock Eastern Time at righthererightnow.businessradiox.com, and the MP3 version is available later today. I am Tim Morrison. Join us next time when business leaders, entrepreneurs, and professionals come together to discuss the power of the pen and its impact on their business right here, right now.